Today, host David Naiman explores the sci-fi world of sleep donation created by author Karen Russell. That's coming up next. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor The Willamette Speaks, Stories of the Lower Willamette River, on Saturday, August 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the BES Water Lab, 6543 North Burlington in North Portland. This storytelling event will feature the Grand Ronde Tribe's history of the river, as well as drumming by tribal members. Raconteur Roger Wendlick will offer a description of Lewis and Clark's first impressions of the Lower Willamette, and Sean Morgan will describe experiences living aboard a sailboat at Willamette Cove. The Willamette River Superfund Community Advisory will be on hand to offer updates, information, and opportunities for community feedback. Again, that's The Willamette Speaks, Stories of the Lower Willamette River, Saturday, August 23rd, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the BES Water Lab. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. You might be surprised to learn that today's guest, Karen Russell, has trouble sleeping. Her first collection of stories, St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves, was named a Best Book of the Year by the Chicago Tribune, Los Angeles Times, and San Francisco Chronicle. Her debut novel, Swamplandia, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Her second story collection, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, was described by NPR as one of the most innovative, inspired short story collections in the past decade. Additionally, Karen Russell was named by The New Yorker as one of the 20 best writers under 40, as one of Granta Magazine's best young novelists, and one of the National Book Foundation's 5 best writers under the age of 35. In 2011, Russell received a Guggenheim Fellowship, in 2012, a National Magazine Award for Fiction, and in 2013, a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. Karen Russell returns to Between the Covers today to talk about what she has been up to in 2014, namely her first novella, Sleep Donation, a dystopian tale about a potentially fatal insomnia epidemic and the moral questions raised by the technology that allows for still healthy dreamers to donate their sleep to those afflicted. Welcome back to Between the Covers, Karen Russell.
Hi, David. I'm so honored to be the first repeat guest.
Yeah, I know. The first person who I've interviewed for the second time.
I'm psyched. I'm going to insist that that goes on every future bio.
That's great. Well, before we talk about the main character of Sleep Donation, let's do a little world building for our listeners. Tell us about the insomnia epidemic. How did it start, or where did it start? Is it affecting everybody in the world? And what's going on as the epidemic begins?
Sure. So the epidemic surprised me too a little bit when I was drafting. I had sort of thought this was going to be like a 3,000 word sort of whimsical riff on the idea of dream donation. You know, sort of an American Red Cross style organization would roll up into your town, and something analogous to blood donation would occur that would let people transfer, healthy sleepers could transfer dreams to insomniacs. That was the kernel that this kind of grew out of. And then somewhere along the way, it took on these sort of global apocalyptic proportions, which was surprising to me and exciting. I thought that, as is often the case, right, there's sort of a gulf between symptom and epidemiology. You know, there's this strange chasm where people don't yet know what's causing the insomnia epidemic, but they can measure effects. So it seems to be happening just in the Americas.
And there's even some skepticism at the beginning about whether it's real. Sort of like reminds me of the beginnings of fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome.
Right. I was thinking about just those strange frontiers, right? So in the rear view, everything has been conjugated and you have this idea that things proceed in kind of a linear fashion and we have names and definitions, but it's wild to read about sort of first cases and the paranoia and suspicion that you come up against. I think with insomnia too, it's such a strange blurring of somatic, psychosomatic. So if I tell you, be anxious, you have insomnia, you won't be able to sleep well. I mean, it's that sort of blurriness, right? So here's something where hypochondriac can actually induce something that really clinically resembles insomnia because you're not sleeping.
And if it's only happening in America, it also sort of hints at the possibility of something about the culture that's interfacing with the psychosomatic.
Right. So I sort of liked, we just, I think, have been inundated with all kind of doom mongering, you know, of late, just all, and people are so concerned, I think, about hyperconnectivity and hyper arousal, and sort of the world is changing at this velocity. I mean, that's really true. I think that we're just, it's a strange thing to be awake and watch it happen.
Introduce us to Trish, the protagonist that we're following in Sleep Donation. What is her story and what is her function in the book?
So Trish, that was when the thing really took off for me, was when she rolled up. I think, again, I thought it was going to be this sort of, I can maybe read you guys, there's this acorn of the thing was just like maybe 500 words that I wrote for this New Yorker assignment, which was to come up with an innovation, imaginary innovation. And so it was just the sleep van and sort of no characters really. It is a little Ben Marcus feeling, I hope, you know, sort of twilight in the suburbs. Something is 1 degree off, you know, it's kind of the world we recognize, but altered in a sinister and sort of unnameable way, atmospherically, whatever. So there's no character in that kernel. And then this lady, I think this first person voice, who is really chatty, kind of neurotic, she's the Slumber Corps is the goofy name I came up with for this organization. Trish is somebody who's really succeeded for them as a recruiter of healthy sleepers because her sister Dory was one of the first victims. So I imagine Dory as being this, you know, more dead sisters. My sister wrote me an email where she was like, "Dear sister, please stop writing about dead sisters. Love your sister." But Dory died of a fatal insomnia. And so Trish sort of, what makes her so skillful at getting these recruits is that she does what I imagined is like a pretty grotesque and visceral performance of her sister's last day. They call the period where you enter total wakefulness, where you know, total cessation of sleep that precedes death, the last day in this weird economy. So she performs sort of the last hour of her sister's last day for people. This is sort of like a coercive strategy to get them to donate their dreams.
And part of what's compelling about it almost is this idea that she has an emotional insomnia. Like she can stay perpetually awake to the grief of her sister. And because she can relive it as if it happened the day before, it seems like that is the power that is really making people say, okay, I want to help. This is very personal.
That's it. That's exactly it. And I think for me, this wound up being sort of a horror story about getting trapped in that limbo state. So if we have like a world of insomniacs who are sort of walking around in twilight, you know, half awake, I was thinking about this as being almost like a sympathetic contagion or something, where Trish is really just cycling through grief pretty relentlessly. Her sister's last day, her sister's death has totally eclipsed every other moment of her real waking life. And that's that, you know, unfortunately, or that just that's what's giving her this ability to, you know, kind of imploring, beseech sleep from these horrified recruits in shopping malls.
Well, I mean, you raise one of the sort of moral centers of the book or ethical dilemmas of the book is, when does recruitment become coercion? But the flip side of that is also the question of what responsibility do individuals have to the whole?
Yeah.
And which you can look at anything from getting vaccinated to driving less to how we eat. And if you have this epidemic, what is the responsibility of an individual to contribute to its solution?
Yeah, that, I mean, I think something about the sort of goofy, if we're on a scale of this world, right, to make it like, you know, millions have insomnia, to sort of blow out the math of it a little bit. And so I think I sort of was trying to straddle some tonal line between total Swiftian satire, you know, and something that feels earnest and meditative about, yeah, grief and responsibility. And gifts and coercion.
Do you see it as an allegory, or
not in the kind of straightforward one to one that implies? Because that would suggest maybe that I have an answer, which I absolutely don't,
right,
to the question of what do we owe one another, and when does a request become something that looks like a demand, or, you know, psychopathy or coercive. Sure. And I think for me, it really was just a landscape where I could sort of move through some of these questions in the skin of Trish. And they're her questions, too. I really saw them as rooted in her character. And she's just sort of, I thought of it as, if there's any kind of optimism in it, I hope that the action of the book kind of gets her to wake up incrementally, wake up a little bit out of her sort of grief formaldehyde suspension, start to kind of consider that she might have her own secret and upsetting motivations that are not so straightforward as, oh, I just want to help insomniacs, I want to do good, you know, capital D, capital G, for repeating her sister's story. And trying to infect these strangers with her sister's story.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today to Karen Russell about her latest novella, Sleep Donation. Well, I really love in your conversation with Stephen King about Sleep Donation, he talks about this concept that he calls the undermind.
Yeah.
And to me, that felt like it had a real resonance with sleep. The idea that he talks about, he puts together the story on the page as he intends, but there's another thing happening that's beyond his control. His undermind is informing the narrative without him knowing, essentially. And it felt very much like the unconscious or sleep mm-hmm. or dream state. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you saw a resonance with the undermind and the sleep epidemic that you're addressing
yeah.
in the book.
Oh, David, I'm so glad you saw that. I think he's so brilliant, so generous, and I thought that was such a lucid and compact and incredible description of a process that can sound sort of Deepak Chopra mysterious, and you don't want to sound like you're wearing a turban covered in stars, you know, ever talking about the undermind or the unconscious. But there is a way that I think is familiar to almost every writer I've ever spoken to, where what you are doing is in excess of your conscious knowledge. So you're putting words down on the paper. Maybe you have some idea, some intention, or sort of a, for me, it's always the lamest ambition for what a story is going to be. And I mean, that absolutely happened while I was writing Sleep Donation. You know, it was just took on a kind of inertia that I hadn't anticipated and had a deeper structure that was only legible to me as I wrote forward. So I would never have been able to tell you on page one, oh, okay, I see what's happening. These are the preoccupations, or I didn't even know Dory until Dory showed up, you know, three paragraphs in. And I think that's so exciting and so terrifying in exactly the same way that being a dreamer is terrifying. Mm. And why we are so obsessed with dreams, which neuroscientists can't tell us if they have any adaptive purpose, right?
Right.
Nobody knows what their function could be, if they even have one, if they're just some spandrel of sleep, if they're, you know, just a way to sort of like a pacifier that we suck on while our body performs metabolic functions.
Yeah.
No, but really nobody knows. But when we wake up, everyone is sort of so excited to clutch at these dissolving fragments of a dream. And I think the part that feels analogous to writing for me is as close to being possessed or something as I think you'll get in this life. You know, it really is pretty close to psychotic states also, where you're aware, but you don't have agency, and you're just, things are truly bizarre, but they have a logic. And you get to eavesdrop on your interior. You're straitjacketed, eavesdropping on a conversation of which you are the architect and, you know, the protagonist. It's just it's a wild thing. And I somehow think that when writing is going well, it can feel like that a little bit.
That the undermind is activated in your writing, essentially.
Yeah, that you're sort of word to word discovering something that there was no other medium to discover. I mean, you could sit there and introspect until dusk and you wouldn't get that story. It's something to do with the mechanical act of putting words on paper. I've never had anything either. This does make it sound kind of like gold star turban dumb. I've never had like automatic writing. I never really feel like I'm taking dictation from ghosts. I would love that, I think, you know, to feel like an antenna for a ghost. Also, that sounds much easier than sort of weighing
a
scarlet
literal ghost writer.
Yeah, I would love to be a literal ghostwriter.
Yeah.
I'd laugh all the way to the bank. But anyway, that's all to say that I do think as an avenue for discovering something inside yourself over which you are maybe helpless or that's beyond your conscious control, dreams and writing, similar,
yeah.
You know? And reading for me, it really has always felt sort of like lucid dreaming, because you're assembling these worlds inside yourself and they're absolutely private.
Did you feel compelled to do research versus just relying on imaginative faculties and your own experience with sleep and your family's experience with sleep?
Oh, I think with this one, there was a way where I wanted, just, I was imagining like a plague like this, there'd be into the void all kinds of speculations and biological and more ridiculous crystals are my medicine, mystic explanations would sort of rush to fill that void. Because I just think that's often what happens in a crisis. You know, yeah. It's a magnet for every kind of, you know, charlatan and neuroscience. Everybody kind of shows up to the party with an explanation. Well, I did do some reading, but I wanted to preserve a space where I could also feel a little magical. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't want people distracted wondering, well, how are these dreams being transferred between bodies? And I also, if I was extrapolating from anything, it was just the activity of writing and reading generally, right? That, to me, has always been how dreams are transferred between bodies.
Speaking of the various theories around this epidemic that rush in to fill the void, and none of them really seem like they're fully comprehensive. Yeah. One of them is this idea that we sit too often in front of the bald eyeballs of our glowing screens, as you say.
Yeah.
And that's, we'll talk about the perversity of the fact that this book only is available as an e-novella, and so we become complicit in the epidemic itself, because we're participating in one of the possible reasons why the epidemic is happening by reading it on a glowing screen. But before we do that, let's have you read from the glowing screen for our listeners so they can hear some of the prose.
All right. So this is the section that sort of the original material that was just cut from this innovations piece. It was a B-side innovation. In high school, the Red Cross blood truck would pull up behind the trailers to collect donations from young Hale students who got to skip homeroom and eat a raisin cookie and relinquish pints of typo. My sister Dory gave, but I never did. I convinced myself that I was scared of needles. If I'd known then that I'd wind up here begging strangers for an hour of their sleep, I think I would have given blood at every opportunity. As a Corps volunteer, my duties are numerous and varied. Weekends, I mobilize the sleep van, a moonlit enterprise that dispatches a volunteer team to the homes of good sleepers who have signed up to donate their rest to insomniacs. A sleep van has a Spartan interior. The beds we call catch cots. If the van is equipped for infants and children, it features catch cribs and trundles. Nurses slip on the anesthetic mask, open the IV of special chemicals, relieving a donor of consciousness. Next, they clamp on and adjust the silver helmet, which does chafe a bit, 1 to 2 minutes after the loss of consciousness. Once the donor enters a state of artificially stimulated sleep, the draw commences. The air in the sleep van turns balmy as the tubing heats. A donor's dream-moist breath gets siphoned into nozzles that connect to our tanks. Healthy sleep is pumped out of the body in long, clear tubes. We set up for sleep drives in neighborhoods all across the country right at sundown. Nurses swab out helmets in multiple vans, preparing to take sleep donations for testing. Administrators sit inside lit tents on suburban lawns, holding clipboards, pre-screening donors with an eligibility questionnaire to filter out those whose sleep is prone to nightmares, disturbance. We babble the questions to volunteers under the midnight pines. When was your last full night of deep, unbroken sleep, ma'am? When did you last dream about barking dogs, outer space, red grass, an ex-wife? Now please be honest, sir. If your sleep was disturbed by her face, check the box.
You've been listening to Karen Russell read from her newest novella, Sleep Donation. So in your conversation with Stephen King, he notices something that I also notice about sleep donation, and it feels like a distinct tonal shift for you from your previous work. And I know when you were last here and we were talking about Vampires in the Lemon Grove, we talked about a couple stories that I felt like I noticed an element of this shift, and namely The Graveless Doll of Eric Mutis and Proving Up, which felt like they were distinctly more dark and moody, and I feel like that element reappears in Sleep Donation, but is coupled with what Stephen King identifies as a hard science fictional approach. I would love to know whether this was something very consciously thought out in your mind as you approached this project, or whether it was just something that felt right as you pushed yourself forward in creating the world and the characters.
As I remember being so excited, you know, you don't always have a sense of what you're up to. I think so much of this novella is about that, right? That you really, it's really difficult. There's just so much is happening that you're not aware of, right? I think we're always kind of writing in a blind spot. So that was such a nice echolocation, David, last time I was here, to hear that that might be one direction. You know, I just do think that you're just sort of flying in the night and you need the echolocation of readers, because mm-hmm. how else would you even know? This was such a joyful project for me. It was right after I had been on book tour for a while for Vampires, and I was sleep deprived and red-eyed and insane. And this just really felt like a strange corner of the eye, like hothouse bloom of a thing. I hadn't had that happen for a while, that I felt so sort of whale swallowed by a story. And it was exciting for me because I didn't know what it was. And it did feel totally sort of different. And I felt kind of giddy thinking, oh yeah, you can flat words on paper, but you can just do this. You can say there's a technology that transfers dreams between bodies. Right. And then kind of ride in that vehicle to sort of some of these huge questions that also surprised me. I think if I had sat down and really consciously thought, oh, I'm curious to explore, you know, what's the true nature of a gift? What do we all want to know? Like, it would have felt terrible, terribly pretentious and impossible. So it was only sort of like zipping into Trish and then walking the night. But it's funny. I just sort of now in retrospect, right? If you want to do the piece out some of the influences, I'm sure Dune is in there. The Wizard of Oz is in there. There are all kinds of funny scramblings, but I don't know that I was so aware of them
earlier. I mean, the place where the horror element and the sci-fi element in Sleep Donation find their sort of nexus or vortex is with Baby A. We learn in Sleep Donation that babies have a pure form of sleep, yeah. a better form of sleep to be donated. But Baby A also, we find out, is a universal donor. And even though one of her parents is reluctant, one is very gung-ho. And so Slumbercore goes back over and over and over again to cajole more donations out of Baby
this
A,
little baby.
Which feels like the real heart of the dilemma of the story. It also feels very vampiric.
Yeah, absolutely right. This was a tough one to pull off because I was thinking, you can imagine, right? Like all the dreadful alternatives where, let's say you're going to write about Oregon. There are other writers that could take on some of these questions in a realist context and say, I'm going to write about Oregon donation. Or, I mean, I think Ishiguro in sort of sci-fi fantasy mode does such a beautiful job of considering a dystopian nightmare future where we're raising these clones for nefarious purposes. I think for me, somehow I was hoping to kind of gong some note that was both darkly funny and then also sort of earnest in its horror and our unregulated appetites. And what would really, I think that if you do sort of just do a set up a what would happen if, where everybody is sleep deprived, and there are children. This is close to Ben Marcus, too, in a funny way, right? I'm sure I was sort of unconsciously influenced by the flame alphabet, where children, they are a resource, you know?
Yeah. But what's interesting, if you think about sleep, is in order to be healthy, we have to stop. We
right.
have to pause. And even though we don't want to. And it's an interesting thing, juxtaposition you've made, where we have this epidemic of people who don't sleep. And are suffering the consequences of not stopping, essentially. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about relentless appetite, how strange that, but also how perfect for the narrative that we would want to just keep going back and tapping this resource,
of course, right?
In order to solve an insomnia epidemic, which was probably caused from that same impulse of wanting
right.
to go back and drawing from our resources without replenishing them.
Right. I mean, I think so many of the stories in Vampires, that would be the font of horror for them too, right? You're vampiric. So the title story, that is the horror story for me. Is sort of, so you have a bottomless appetite. How do you regulate it? You know, how, and we've done just like our track record on this planet, not excellent, right? In terms of, yeah, finding ways to regulate a thirst that we can assume, you know, and that's endless. So that to me too, you know, I think the term that I use in the novella is hydrology of human generosity. I just have been fascinated recently with sort of where and how and why we give to each other, what we can give, and you know, what the membranes are and what the physics of that transfer are, where it's conscious and where it's unconscious, and where we sort of like tighten our fists and resist, and where it's easy to have kind of an open palm transfer. I think so much fiction is driven by that also. Mm. You know, Mrs. Harkonnen, the mother in this book, she in some ways is also a horrifying character to me. She's someone who lets the slumber court come and basically drain her daughter, and does seem to feel a total commitment to the project of giving sleep. Feels, you know, a matter of fact generosity that I've just, as a, you know, from out here, you know, as her creator or whatever, but find really scary and provocative, you know, the idea of like, where would you, how those lines get drawn.
Mm. And if you really are focusing on treating the symptom rather than going for the cause, unforeseen consequences are inevitable, it would seem to me. And in this case, people receive sleep donations that are blends from many donors. It reminded me of the way if you eat industrial hamburger, you're getting, you know, a hamburger that's coming from like many cows and from all different states, which makes it inevitable that if there's a contamination, it's going to spread really quickly. And we have to confront that in the world of sleep donation as well. A nightmare that runs loose and is hard to track down.
Oh yeah. This is going to sound like a weird tangent, but you know, I'm new to Portland. There's so many sort of like food accommodations made here, and you sort of like, you know, all kinds of, corruption fears, I think, around food, like food taboos. That feels sort of new. And I was thinking about what we're exposed to on a daily basis now that has to just the complete volitionless immersion in like other minds, you know, or just the noise. You know, I think Saunders is another, George Saunders, who I know we're both huge fans of. The horror stories he writes, they're often about what it is to be hostage to such advertising noise. And so many, you know, that sort of constant drone of solicitation and like whatever the deforming waves of that kind of forcible capitalist dream, you know, where you're just sort of, you're an eyeball that people are trying to shove advertisements into and program desires into all the time around the clock, you know. And I think he, in that sense, that's some of that horror, I think, is inside of this novella for me, too. Just what it is to sort of be, have all of these like lame wizards trying to put a spell on you all the time from different media outlets.
I'm mostly a Luddite in the sense that I love reading books, physical objects. But I found a perverse pleasure that I was forced to read this on a screen and was implicated in the narrative, essentially, by watching it on a screen. I wondered if that was an intentional part of choosing to go with atavist books and to have a digital only version of sleep donation.
Yeah. So that, I mean, like everything else, I guess in the gestation of this one, sort of both serendipitous and accidental and also then intentional, where early on, you know, I was working on this draft and it had gotten so long and I just didn't see where we would ever publish something that was this hybrid piece and felt really kind of like a risk and weird for me, and wasn't a short story, and also I didn't, you know, wasn't going to be a novel, you know, it just felt like this hybrid creation. And Atavist Books was sort of just looking for manuscripts, and at first I was a little suspicious because I'm a Luddite too and I love books and I love print, and then I met with Francis Cody at Atavist Books, who's fantastic, and we talked a little bit about sort of what their project is and these as a forum for really kind of sui generis, weird, mutant digital books. And they do print too, some digital only, some print. And this, the more we talked about it, the more I started to think in a perverse way, digital only would be perfectly correct for a story about an insomnia epidemic that's in sort of like the neon campfire, you know, of the witching hour, the new witching hour. And I'm so glad that you feel implicated a little bit in a different way, especially with the ending. I think I was hoping that there might be some third term complicity or something if you're receiving Dory's story through this glowing device. And it is sort of foregrounding meditations on what does it mean to be awake, half awake? What does it mean to be connected to so many other minds in this anonymous way?
It was great having you on Between the Covers again, Karen.
All right, David. Thank you. I want to try for guest three. I'm going to keep writing so you have me back. Thanks, David.
You've been listening to Between the Covers, and we've been talking today to Karen Russell about her latest e-novella, Sleep Donation. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale coming soon, and we are accepting donations now. The sale will be held sometime this fall. The book and record sale is a great way to help contribute to your community. So do us and yourself a favor. Clear out those books, comics, DVDs, VHS tapes, LPs, and CDs collecting dust around your abode and bring them down to the station. 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, during our business hours. Got questions? Contact Jesse at 503-231-8032, extension 213, or online via email, volunteer@kboo.org. Remember, the stuff that you're sick of, others may treasure. Turn your clutter into cash for your community radio station, KBOO.
Monday, August 18th at 6:30 p.m., join KBOO at the Clinton for a screening of Woodstock, the director's cut. This landmark concert film is the definitive record of that three-day cultural event. Director Michael Wadley worked with over 300 hours of footage to create his original 225-minute director's cut. Again, that's Woodstock, the director's cut, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.